Welcome back and welcome to Palestine Deep Dive, where we examine the big issues in the Middle East and with a special focus on Palestine. And this week, I'm delighted to be joined once again by our old friend, Tariq Ali. Tariq needs no introduction, but he's going to get one anyway. Of course, Tariq is a political activist, writer, journalist, historian, and filmmaker. He's a member of the editorial committee of the New Left Review and contributes to Counterpunch, the London Review of Books, and many other publications. Throughout this grotesque war, Tariq, of course, has been playing a very prominent part, very prominent role in the campaign and the marches for peace and ceasefire and a final settlement in Gaza. And of course, in the same way that Tariq has been active from the 1960s onwards, and we will touch on that briefly today, because there are, of course, lessons from the past. Because the past we inherit, the future we build. I kept on seeing that at the Durham Miners Gala this weekend on all of those banners that went past. Tariq, I didn't see you on the banners, unfortunately, but that'll be, no doubt, you'll be there one day. But there were various other people that I'm sure you would have approved of on the banners. Just to say that, of course, Tariq is also an author of very many books. You can look them up if you haven't. You've probably read many of them anyway. I'm Mark Seddon. I used to work for Al Jazeera, and I also used to work for the United Nations. And I was a speechwriter for Ban Ki-moon for a while. Back in the day, I used to edit a left-wing paper called Tribune, which is still around and still fairly left-wing. But look, Tariq, if I could just begin. We're looking at this great wave of global demonstrations. You know, every week in capitals across the world and cities and towns, even villages, I mean, it has been quite extraordinary. And there's been taking place almost every weekend or every week since the Israeli attacks on Gaza began almost 9 months ago. And I wanted to ask you this because it's always an excuse to remind ourselves that this comment from former Chinese Premier Chou Enlai, I don't know whether you'll tell me if he actually said this or not, but he was asked apparently in 1972 as to the effects of the French Revolution, to which he was supposed to have said, "It's too early to say." So, Tariq, on the basis of that is not apocryphal and it's true. Is it too early to say how this global response to Israel's murderous campaign and the role of the West versus the rest effectively, is influencing a whole new generation of people?
First, I think it's important to sort out the Chou Enlai statement. It's not true, it's apocryphal. What he actually said, which was misinterpreted by the journalist and by the rest of the world, not so much by the journalist. The journalist asked him, "What do you think of the 1968 revolutionary events in France?" And to that, the Chinese prime minister replied, "It's too early to say." And he was right. But because of China's ancient civilization, many papers sort of glorified this into a classic Chinese comment on the long durée. History is a long process. Yeah, but returning to the demonstrations and the mobilizations, I have not seen anything like this ever before. Even on Vietnam, you know, where everyone now claims, "Oh yes, we were against the war, they weren't. I mean, it was at the height of the Cold War. Vietnam was seen by the United States and its allies as part of the Cold War. Most of the press in Britain supported the US. And in the early days, most of the press in the US supported the war. The only country which didn't support the war was France, under General de Gaulle at the time, who had learned enough, had experiences in Algeria and Vietnam. He said, "This is wrong. It should be stopped immediately. And it's a huge mistake the Americans have made, which they'll regret." Interestingly, not a single European country, including Harold Wilson's Labour government in Britain, agreed to send troops to fight with the Americans in Vietnam. The only two countries that did were Australia and South Korea. And the Australian people revolted and elected Gough Whitlam, a Labour leader, as Prime Minister. And Gough had pledged that if he were elected, he would pull the troops out. And he did, for which he was punished by the British state and removed from office. And then the late John Pilcher described it as a sordid, unpleasant constitutional coup d'etat. So it was a different period in many ways. What we are seeing now is that the United States, with most of Europe, with the exceptions of Spain and Ireland, supporting the United States and the war in Israel. I mean, this is a genocide supported by NATO, supported by the United States, and all the organizations that were created soon after the Second World War are lying fallow. They're ignored. The ICC that was created relatively recently, ignored. Pressure put on it, withdraw your charges. The International Court of Justice, initiated by the South Africans, the case found Israel, the judgment was Israel had a case to answer, and a genocide of sorts was taking place. Ignored. Human rights organization like Amnesty, ignored. So what we have, Mark, is a very dangerous situation at the moment, where without the support of the United States, nothing can be done through global institutions. This poor and very courageous Secretary General of the UN is really tearing his hair out. He's attacked the genocide. He's attacked with the no impact. Why? Because it now comes clear as the masks come off that behind all these things, unless you have US support, you can't move. That's the big problem. Counter to that, we have the mass mobilizations from below. The only real, serious, consistent opposition to Israeli barbarism in Palestine that we are witnessing.
I mean, Terry, it does, for many across the world, look as though it's the West against the rest. What you were saying there, and the comparisons you were making also with the Vietnam War and also the Iraq War as well. I mean, there were huge public protests that did have a major influence. And yet we can see some of the influences beginning to play out here. But I think people are really quite, they're trying to come to terms with the fact that it's just so impervious. You know, what is this utter block? And you sometimes sit back and you wonder, what is it, what is going through a new British Foreign Secretary's head when he's just seen what has happened to some of his colleagues, when he's seen all the protests in the street? He must know, unless he hasn't got a brain functioning, that having a photograph taken, shaking the hand of Benjamin Netanyahu, really isn't going to go down very well across the rest of the world. So what is it that's making, as you say, the US State Department, Israel, do they really have such a hold on a political class and political institutions in other countries?
They seem to now. they didn't have it on previous occasions. After all, let's not forget, Israel got bowled out by Truman, Eisenhower told them to get out of Gaza within 2 weeks or sanctions would be imposed after the Suez War by Bush the First, who threatened to withdraw billions of dollars of aid unless they came to the conference table, etc. This regime or series of regimes, beginning with Clinton, going through Obama, Bush Jr., and now with Biden, both political parties as one, refusing to tackle the very serious problem that the way in which Israel functions has created both in Palestine and the rest of the Arab world, and now they're screaming for Iran to be invaded, for Hezbollah to be taken on. I think there is a deep crisis of political strategy at the top levels of the American administration. I mean, to have a half-demented president in charge for the last 2 years doesn't speak well. And I always point out when people say, I said, if Biden alone were running the administration, we could say that. But he is surrounded by state agencies, by the Department of Defense. What are they saying to him? And, you know, were he to drop, basically they would, the state apparatus would control like they did during the Reagan years. You know, when Reagan used to land in Guatemala and think he was in Salvador, you know, people would come quickly. When Biden, you know, welcomes Putin rather than Zelensky at a conference recently, people try and save him. But behind all this, there is a serious American state, and that state doesn't know what to do. And that is the frightening thing. I don't know what the big discussions are going on in the CIA and the Defense Intelligence Agency, but the Israelis, retiring Israeli generals, are now saying, we can't win this war.
Yes.
Some are saying we've lost it, Mark. As for Britain, you know, quite honestly, since Suez in 1956, a war they waged without US permission, they've been reduced to the status of a satrapy. They're sort of US, they do what the US says, their military, their intelligence networks are totally linked in. The last revolt from within the British state was during Iraq, when 60 former ambassadors wrote a public letter to the Times saying this war was wrong and should not take place, which was an enormous help to those of us organizing the demonstrations. So it's much worse than that now. When Starmer and Lammy and this and that person basically say we can't go against the United States. We can't call for a ceasefire till the United States calls for a ceasefire. They have actually said that.
Yes, yes.
You know, so it's the worst government, and they are now putting pressure on police force as well to stop demonstrators. I mean, tiny groups, 50 people saying don't sell arms to Israel, being picked up off the parks and streets and locked up for a day or so. It's pretty bad, which is why the demonstrations really have to continue in whatever shape or form. They must not stop till this bloody genocide is stopped.
No, it's very interesting that in a domestic context, I mean, you know, this past weekend in Durham, I think there was some concern that pressure had come from the police that if Ambassador Zomrot was to appear, that could be an issue of public safety. So you do see this really quite pernicious things happening. But I just want, I know we don't, I mean, we're going to focus very much on an international scale, but I just wanted to focus on one domestic issue, Tariq, which was the, and you probably saw it yesterday, not necessarily a great friend of people like you or me or Omar or anybody else, but Alan Duncan, former Conservative minister. I mean, this was an extraordinary thing. And for people who didn't see it, here was a former Conservative minister who faced what he said were a series of concocted charges that emanated as a result of some claims from the British Board of Deputies and an outfit called the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. These, he said, were then crafted into charges by senior unnamed Tories from the Conservative Friends of Israel. And I was listening to this and thinking, it's quite extraordinary that these links are so powerful that actually these, when he said Conservative Friends of Israel, for some reason, I immediately started thinking about Labour Friends of Israel. And probably, I mean, I've got no evidence, but it would suggest that the same kind of tactics have been used against countless numbers of people. But in the case of the Labour Party, the idea of getting some due process that at least Alan Duncan could get, also because he's sufficiently wealthy to get lawyered up. But this does tell you something about the rotten nature and how it is so difficult to get things to change in these political parties, doesn't it?
I agree entirely, Mark. I was very pleasantly surprised, A, that Alan Duncan had gone to court, which I didn't know, B, that he had actually won the case. And, you know, there were people at the time that the British state and the Labour Party right wing, which now has the party, decided to use anti-Semitism to bring Corbyn down. My instinct at the time, and I said so in public and to Jeremy and his allies, that you have to fight back. Do not accept it. Say it's a load of rubbish. Don't be defensive. And in some cases, I suggested worth going to court because it's a slander. The worst order to say you're anti-Semitic and by implication support the Judeo side of the Second World War. I mean, if someone called me that, I wouldn't be bothered to sue. But, you know, I would be tempted if a lawyer, lefty lawyer, said, let's take them on. And a Tory, former Tory cabinet minister, taking them on like this should be a lesson to even the left MPs inside the Labour Party who've been denounced as that. The fact is that inside Labour, as you know, Mark, more Jews have been suspended, I think, than at any other time in the history of the Labour Party. It's just they're the wrong kind of Jews. They're not the good Jews. The good Jews are the Zionists. The bad Jews are the anti-Zionists. That's how they function today in Germany, in Britain, in France. So, and not to mention the United States. So it's a very strange, weird world we live
in. Well, do you know, Tariq, I was going to come on to this because I mean, there are a couple of things that come out of that in a funny way, because you see in America the rise of the fundamentalist Christian evangelical right, and with this guy, J.D. Vance, who's now a vice president candidate wannabe, a very interesting backstory and all the rest of it, but at the same time, a visceral kind of anti-Muslim racism that comes through from so many of these people. And then there's also the contrast in Germany, which you just mentioned, where, for instance, you find the Green Party being one of the most kind of
reactionary in Germany.
Exactly. Now, what is it? Or is there something deeper informing all of this? Kind of in the case of America, there's the right-wing anti-Muslim thing going on. In Germany, some weird kind of... I'm not asking you to be a kind of psychologist or whatever on a national scale, but something very weird is happening in Germany. And a lot of people were trying to get their heads around it.
The States is a bit different. There is Islamophobia and has been ever since 9/11. Muslims have been under fire and attacked. I mean, one tiny episode, Mark, which symbolizes this. I was speaking a lot in the States after 9/11, and I met a friend, not a friend, a guy who read my books, who's in the bookshop. And the bookshop owner said, tell Tariq your story. He was a Muslim guy, Harvard, PhD. So he said, I said, tell me. He said, my dad was a Republican, a Muslim surgeon, who'd given lots of money to the Republican Party. He was one of the top heart surgeons in the United States. And the day after 9/11, he was on Vice President Cheney's medical staff. He was sacked. I said, just like that. He said, yes. And he'd saved Cheney's life. In a life-saving operation not so long ago. So I said, for that alone, he should be charged in private by his family. And they said, we go on all the time about it. You've given so much money to the Republicans. You've done that, and this is the result. So it happened on a top level, too, not just against you know, working class or shopkeeper Muslims, etc. And it's been going on, and it picks up during the Iraq war again, and now, of course, in Palestine. The difference with the US and the rest of Europe is this, that the young Jews who've come out against the war in the United States are admirable. You know, they occupied Grand Central, they've been on all the demonstrations, they take part in the encampments, and Jews in Britain too, Jews for Justice, the Jewish bloc has been getting bigger and bigger on demonstrations. This is not so in France. In Germany, young Jews protesting against what's happening in Palestine have been picked up brutally by German soldiers and locked up. So much for respecting the Jewish identity. And Germany, I think, has just completely flipped, even before this. The Greens, by the way, have been going rightward since the Yugoslav war. They were strongly in favor of it, in favor of NATO. I gave up on them, just treated them as yet another small bourgeois party whose leaders are total opportunists. And that's now been completely vindicated. But the real danger is that with this sort of extreme center bloc, the Greens, the Social Democrats, the Christian Democrats, etc., behaving like this, people go to the far right. Mm. They don't go to the left, you know. And so you have the AfD, a mass right-wing party, which contains fascists inside its ranks. One of their sort of minor leaders was expelled a few weeks ago for saying that the SS did a lot of good things. So I'm sure from his point of view, they did. So they've not supported the war in Ukraine. That's a big point of difference with the Germans. They're against the war, quite a lot of them. Mm. On Palestine, the ones who don't like what's happening to the Palestinians tend to remain silent. The ones who speak out are people of migrant origins, Arabs, Palestinians, others who happen to be in Germany. So they haven't been able to totally stop the demonstrations in Germany.
Yeah.
But it's a very strange country to be in. And today they're saying that they want to sabotage the ICC's warrants. They've said it openly. We're getting our lawyers working on this to stop this prosecution from going ahead.
Well, we'll see about that because... I mean, Daniel Mackover has got some very interesting things to say about how individual countries can try and block arrest warrants. We'll see it. But I mean, it goes back to your point about the international institutions created by countries like Germany and Britain. And yet when they start acting in a way that governments don't like, I mean, just as an aside, when you were talking about, you know, what happens when the center, whatever you call a center, it's called the center,
extreme center.
When it fails, people go not to the left but to the right to begin with. That if you look at the old coal fields and many of the constituencies across this country, Reform UK was in second place.
I know.
And in that constituency that Luke Akers won, he would have been beaten by Reform and the Tories combined. So, I mean, you know, straws in the wind and everything. But Tariq, I just want really to go to something that happened yesterday. You will have seen it. The Knesset voted overwhelmingly against any two-state solution. I think there were about only 8 members, probably Arab Palestinian members who opposed it. And, you know, given that the two-state solution, I know it's the official United Nations position of member states and what have you, but it is the fig leaf that's kind of waved whenever a Western minister goes to Israel or Palestine. But given that Netanyahu and the Israelis, we know Netanyahu's never had any time for a two-state solution.
No.
They will want a one-state solution with the Palestinians out. So yeah. I've been increasingly interested, like a lot of us have, in what you've been talking about in terms of de-recognizing Israel. Mm-hmm. And presumably, when you say that Israel should be de-recognized, you're saying that really there should be a one-state solution, a secular democratic one.
Absolutely. And you know what I was very struck by? after this particular genocide began, that Noam Chomsky's first comment — he's now sadly ill and paralyzed in hospital and can't speak — but Noam's first comment in public, when he was asked, "What do you think about the war?" And Noam just said, "Israel should no longer exist." It stunned me, because that had never been his position before. And some people misinterpreted it. He was not saying, you know, the Jews should be chucked out or anything remotely. What he was saying is that the Israeli Jews alone could not be allowed to run the state. You needed a single secular democratic state with equal rights for Palestinians, Muslims, Jews, whoever. And that had never been Noam's or Norman Finkelstein's position before. I don't know whether Noam has changed his, but I was glad Noam has, because this is an argument that's been going on amongst us and in public on the left for a long, long time. Let me give you another episode on this. About 10 years ago, Mark, I was invited by the Spanish Foreign Office to engage in a public seminar debate with the former Israeli foreign minister, Shlomo Ben Ami. And we discussed, you know, we disagreed and discussed over lunch that same day. And I had been stressing that the two-state solution was a non-starter, because the Israelis had no intention of giving even a tincture of sovereignty to the Palestinians. And he had, you know, sort of mildly disagreed. And over lunch, the Spanish Foreign Office officials asked Shlomo Ben Ami, trying to ingratiate himself a bit, saying, "Do you think Tariq Ali was too harsh today?" And Ben Ami said, "No, actually, yeah. I can now say to you, he's right. There is no two-state solution. There is only a single-state solution. And it's our policies that have led to that, that we have now ourselves created a situation where nothing else is possible." The Spanish. So I said to him, "Please take this back to your foreign office. Tell them it's just a joke to carry on talking about a two-state solution. It's just a fig leaf, Mark. There's nothing. It's nothing more. It's like the other business which is going on. X country, Spain, Ireland, blah, long, from all over the world, recognize Palestine, fine, as a symbolic gesture, good even, but it means nothing. Because what are you recognizing? Nothing. You're recognizing the Palestinian Authority, which has been collaborating and still is to this day with the Israelis, refuses to criticize Israel at all, and is hoping that the Americans will somehow protect it. Which is clearly not happening. So the only serious demand today, I think, is de-recognize Israel, withdraw your ambassadors, break off relations with them, break off trade relations with them. The Yemenis, you know, for all their sort of romanticism, have actually been successful. They have closed down the port of Eilat in Israel, where hardly any trade is flowing. They're in a terrible mess, because they said, "We're not going to let these ships cross. You want to come and attack us and kill us," they say to the Americans, "do it. You've been doing it for the last so many years. Where has it got you? Our people are without arms and legs. We're prepared to do this sacrifice for Palestine."
I mean, so, Tariq, do you not think, I mean, all of this and that vote yesterday, and what, of course, we've all been saying about Netanyahu for years, it really does crystallize everything, because people will be able to see that what Netanyahu wants, a greater Israel, with only those Palestinians, Arabs, Palestinian Muslims, Christians, only those people who are prepared to live as second-class citizens remaining. That's his one state, in comparison with what everybody else is outlining and saying could be a secular democratic state. I mean, isn't everybody supposed to be in favor of one person, one vote? And so it becomes so crystallized that Netanyahu has to go for this kind of existential endgame war? And do you think that really he is waiting for a Trump presidency? Although Trump doesn't like Netanyahu much, but is he waiting really to? He's been pushing for it, but does he want this kind of endgame war, where you know, Greater Israel somehow emerges from the ashes of a crushed Iran, a crushed Palestine, and everything else? Is that really what he's about?
I think so. That's why we call it a genocide. I mean, anyone, even sort of unbiased people who don't support either side, are pretty horrified by this war. They won't open their mouths, but they are. They don't want to take sides in public. They know what's going on, that the Palestinian population in Gaza and its environs is slowly being wiped out, with the Western world watching, with the citizens of the West sleepwalking to their offices every day, trying to imagine it's not going on, it doesn't exist. And Mark, one thing we haven't discussed, but the victory of some of these independents in the British general election is a new development. You know, that has not happened since the Second World War, when I think two communists were elected, one in the East and then one in Scotland, as a result of the Soviet victories in that war. Till after that, Labour has exercised a very firm monopoly hold on working class and progressive representation in Parliament. Jeremy broke that, thank God. It would have been depressing had he lost. But other independents too, of one sort or another. So this is the direct result of Gaza. That has never happened in Britain before, that Britain has ever been deluged politically by a foreign war that it is supporting. And similar things will happen in the United States, because a number of states, Michigan to start off with, but also Florida and others, two others, which have large Arab populations, said, we will never vote Trump, but we're not going to vote for Biden either. So what is being created per force is a new current. I won't go beyond that, which is very positive. But coming
back, Tariq, if I might just come in there, it's a new current, and also it's coming in on the back of something that's clearly dying, and that is in terms of the turnout in the British general election, record low. The fact that the Starmer's changed Labour Party actually got fewer overall votes than Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party led by Jeremy Corbyn in 2017 and 2019. And then, of course, these independent candidates, as you say, but also the loss, Jonathan Ashworth lost his seat. Wes Streeting almost did. I mean, quite profound things are happening. And I suppose I hadn't thought about asking this, but it becomes bigger as things move on. Because in 2 to 3 years, the Palestine issue, Gaza issue, clearly has profoundly influenced a lot of people. And it's all very well for the right-wing media to concentrate and say it's a British Muslim issue. It's far, far wider than that. We all know that. But does it get to the stage, perhaps 2 to 3? I know this is crystal ball gazing. But does possibly the potential of a wider war that NATO seems to want to fight against Russia play into this as well? And there's a much, much bigger anti-war peace progressive movement that grows out of all of this?
Difficult to say, Mark, but I think some of the problem for the European hawks on Ukraine, the Germans and the British in particular, but also Macron in France, is that on the question of Ukraine, Trump and Vance want to bring the war to an end. Both of them have said it in different ways. So you might have a clash, which the Americans will obviously win, of a negotiated settlement in Ukraine. And whatever, I mean, as you know, we were all opposed to what Putin did. But the only way out now is not escalation, but a negotiated settlement. Gaitskell used to say it once upon a time, Georgia, not war. He said it over Suez, and the same thing applies here. And the British will fall into line. I mean, the parliament, which abased itself by kowtowing before Zelensky, will kowtow before someone else when the media needs to build him or her up. Don't worry about that. That'll happen. So if a Trump victory, ironically enough, could make Europe more peaceful, the China is the big worry, that they might start some adventures in China, because they cannot tolerate its remarkable economic growth and its standing in the world. They say it openly. The fact China is doing so well challenges the United States. And for them, the only way out is war. And the Chinese statements, I have to say, on Palestine of late have been very good, you know, trying to sort of end this business, as they have on Ukraine. And as long as the Chinese were quiescent and supporting U.S. foreign policy, there was nothing wrong with China at all. What a wonderful demonstration of the glories of world capitalism. But now that they've become independent and asserting their own sovereignty, oh, they are bad people. They're a danger to us.
Well, Tarek, you'll remember when President Putin spoke to President Clinton about joining NATO.
I know. I know. And why didn't they have the Russians in NATO? They could have controlled them because Russia was too big. Yeah. That's what they felt. A, well, and B, that Russian-German complementarity on many levels could actually damage US interests.
Yes, yes. Tarek, you know, we're conscious of time. I've just got a couple more questions for you. And one comes up all the time, and that is from people who look, who've been right across the world, marching, demonstrating, doing whatever they conceivably can, and then looking at the response of the Arab world. I don't mean the people, the Arab street, because we know how people are treated who go on the street in many Arab countries, but people cannot fathom how it is that the Arab world, Egypt in particular, the Gulf states, have just sat by and allowed this genocide to continue. What is your explanation for this?
My explanation for this is that they have completely and utterly, the Gulf states were never anything else but glorified petrol stations, first of the British Empire and then the American Empire, so I don't give them too much attention. Jordan has been an Israeli-American protectorate ever since the Cold War came to an end, and the Egyptian army sold out after the 73 war and agreed to do a deal with Israel, which included no questioning of what the Israelis were up to. When Mubarak was being toppled, he rang up his Israeli minister friend and said, look, the people are out against me. And the Israeli minister said, what about the army? He knew where the power was. And Mubarak evidently replied, according to reports, uncertain. And the Israeli said, then you're sunk. But the thing is this, that the Israelis immediately transferred their support to Sisi. They did not want an elected Muslim Brotherhood government, which, of course, as we know, made huge mistakes, and toppled it and got Sisi even elected with the liberals in tow. And this has turned out to be a complete disaster because there is more torture, more arrests, more horrific stories coming out than even during the Mubarak years. So that is what keeps Egypt in line, is the billions it gets from the United States. The army is bought by the United States. And unless there's a radicalization of young officers in the army, that will not happen unless there's mass uprisings. If there is a mass uprising in Egypt, and it's a huge if, then the army will split because people have memories, they have traditions. But failing that, no. But you know, worse even than Egypt in a way, which is trapped by its own foolishness, is countries like Morocco supplying refuge to Israeli trade and warships. I mean, Mossad organizes the palace guard of the King of Morocco. So the Israelis have been incredibly clever in penetrating and infiltrating these societies. Egypt, they can't to the same extent as they can Morocco. But the only way out is, unfortunately, one has to say this, is this huge national uprisings to topple these regimes who will fight back viciously. And which is why people are scared, given what's already happened in that country. Then you take that Libya, Iraq, Syria, the three countries which had some semblance of national sovereignty, all been destroyed. Syria survived, but it's still being bombed either by the Israelis or the Americans. Iraq, there's still Americans in there. They haven't completely withdrawn. And they now want to tackle Iran. So the Middle East, I think, remains the most dangerous and explosive place for them, which is why the saner, marginally more rational elements in American ruling elite circles, including the army, want some settlement in Israel, which they can pretend is yet again a master settlement. Look, we've saved everything, etc., etc. And some bogus Bantustan-type states, which they'll now try and create again, as long as they get rid of Netanyahu. There's no way to get rid of Netanyahu electorally. Unfortunately, he's quite popular. I mean, according to reports, that he might even win again, or his party might win again without him. And some elements in his party, in his cabinet, are worse than even him. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at a right-wing, far-right takeover of the Israeli government, with the Israeli state divided in terms of which way to go forward. That's what's going on. And in this situation, the Palestinian Authority, were it even possible for it to act as an independent force, could play a role, but they will not do it. I mean, Hanan Ashrafi and a few others, brave characters speak up, but from Abbas and the rest of this corrupt gang, nothing, absolutely nothing, which is a disgrace, as Palestinians are being killed every single day, both in Gaza and the West Bank.
Look, finally, Tarek, I mean, and, I suppose it's quite a big question, but panning through the past decades, you were part and parcel of the great campaign against the Vietnam War. You've been part of the anti-colonial struggles as well, and seen the end of apartheid South Africa. You were heavily involved in all of that. You were opposed to the Iraq War. People such as you and others, none of us could prevent it, but we can look back and say we were right. Most people agree with us. So you've seen so many times when terrible things have happened, but people have been able to affect change. They have been able to turn things around and to stop them. The Vietnam War did come to an end. There was pressure on that Harold Wilson Labour government you referred to. They didn't even send a bunch of people playing the bagpipes. So what would you say to people now, you know, those people who've been out on the streets every day, every week over Palestine, not just here, but all over the place, who are feeling right now rather powerless. I'm thinking, what on earth else can we do? What message, I'm looking back over the decades, and from your experience, would you give them?
I would say don't give up, because the very fact that you've been demonstrating on the streets here in the United States, the encampments, elsewhere, regular, consistent demonstrations, especially in the third world, barring India, which has been a disaster. But I would just say don't give up, because you are the opposition, not just on Gaza, but the way you're behaving, the way you're acting, the way you're beginning to recognize what the West is and how the West ignores all its own so-called values when it needs to, shows that our presence is absolutely necessary. And it's not much, but it's nothing compared to what the Palestinians are suffering. So we owe this to the Palestinians to stay out as long as they're out, and they're out with bombs and drones and killings and tanks. No one is doing that to the demonstrators as yet. There have been episodes in the United States of sort of police brutality on some campuses, and here the police are getting more vicious with the Labour Home Secretary trying to show her, throw her weight around. They want to end this because they link it also to their own decline as a political force in this country. What can we do, Mark? We fight on the best way we can, on the streets, with our pens, with making documentaries, with doing whatever we can. In a curious way, we can do more now with many alternative means, like this podcast, than we could in the 60s or 70s or 80s. This technological transformation has also been very beneficial for the creation and emergence of new opposition forces all over the world.
Thank you very, very much indeed, Tariq. Thanks to Tariq Ali for being with us today. And thank you also for joining us from wherever you are. So until the next time, from Tariq and from Omar and all our colleagues at Palestine Deep Dive, thank you very much and see you next time.